From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe joins us with stories that we call high strangeness, followed by, of course, conversations with Linda. Here's what's happening. Well, now it's Russia's turn. Russia has expelled 60 U.S. diplomats and closed the St. Petersburg consulate in response to the U.S. action over a spy poisoning case in the U.K. We shut down their consulate in Seattle. The moves were announced by the Russian foreign minister. It comes amid a new row over the nerve agent attack on a former Russian spy and his daughter in the United Kingdom. Dr. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com. Boy, this sounds like the Cold War all over again, John.
Oh, it's getting that way. I mean, it's been that way for a long time. But I mean, I think what you're dealing with Putin right now is an isolation, a Stalinist-like isolation that, you know, he had some pretty good rapport with, the European Union for quite some time. He supplies about 30% of their natural gas and petroleum to the EU. So, you know, the EU, on the one hand, you know, has business ties with Russia that we don't, and they want to continue those. On the other hand, I think they're taking this this nerve agent, this Novichok nerve agent attack, very seriously. That agent, by the way, was 10 times the toxicity of VX nerve gas. That's why there were so many people, including first responders, that were contaminated
by it
and became sickened. Now, the good news is that the 33-year-old daughter of Skripal, the former, GRU agent, is apparently recovering. He's still in critical condition, but apparently she's been upgraded to stable. So it is a serious situation, and there's no possible other explanation other than this was orchestrated by some element of the Russian government. And I don't think you can point exactly the finger at Putin, but you can certainly say that no one else possesses that nerve agent other than the Russians.
Why get this guy? He was retired, ineffective. Why go after him?
Well, I think that there's a lot of vindictiveness and retaliation that goes on with especially double agents that, you know, betray their, you know, their former Soviet, minders. The dirty game, the double agent game, and, you know, when you play both sides of the sword, you really wind up getting sliced in two. And I think that while he did have political asylum, the Russians have been known for years to go after former agents when they think that they're participating with NATO and Western authorities. But Putin has gotten into a very paranoid kind of state. The West is against him now, and you know they're picking on him. He's the victim. Poor Russia. Orchestrated by the United States and by Great Britain, they've trashed their wonderful reputation in the world. Well, you know, I think there's a number of people that are looking very carefully right now at how you can continue to do business with this guy.
By the way, did you know that the late Nikita Khrushchev, the Soviet Union's head, his last remaining child, Sergei Khrushchev, is now living in the United States?
Oh, I'm not surprised.
How about that?
I've heard that before, and I think that many former the families of Russian officials living under the kind of we don't realize how lucky we are in this country to live with the kind of freedoms that we have, and I think that those refugees from extremely repressive regimes, you know, all over the planet, that manage somehow to find their way into the United States to live in freedom, know the value of it. And I think sometimes we forget that and how important this is. And that segues very nicely into this development that's happening in North Korea right now, which is on the one hand very promising, but there are a lot of skeptics out there that think that Kim Jong-un will do what his father Kim Jong-il did before, and that is set these impossible preconditions for disarmament. But my read on the situation is, and I do have some very close contacts that have informed me that Beijing has informed Kim that if he doesn't denuclearize, then he can't help their country in the event of a U.S. attack. And
yes,
I've repeated that before.
I'm hearing that too,
and I maintain that right now. And that's the reason why he's coming to the table.
We shall see what happens. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com. Pope Francis is once again under a global spotlight for reported comments to a journalist that conflict with 2,000-year-old Roman Catholic doctrine. This time, the veteran Italian journalist Eugenio Scalafari, he's an atheist, is reporting that the Pope declared that hell does not exist. People went crazy. The Vatican, by the way, immediately issued a statement claiming that what was reported is not the Pope's words, but the art, but the author's own reconstruction of the Pope's words. Scientists have turned their attention to investigating that most annoying of human habits, the sound made when you crack your knuckles. I kid you not, the characteristic pop can be explained by mathematical equations, according to researchers. Their model confirms the idea that the cracking sound is due to tiny bubbles collapsing in the fluid of the joints as the pressure changes. There you go, a little news you can use. China's spiraling space station looks like it will plummet to Earth and burn up in the atmosphere sometime on April 1st, though where it will fall, whatever remains of it, still up for debate, could be New York, could be Salt Lake City, could be Detroit, could be Australia, hopefully the ocean. Listen to this incredible story we've been following over the last couple days. Two pilots claim a UFO flew near them while they were traveling over Arizona last month. Newly released audio recordings revealed this. Listen to it.
Was anybody in front above us the past like 30 seconds ago?
We're 7-1 Papa Golf, negative.
Okay. Stop this. It's a UFO.
It's all a UFO. That's what the pilots were saying. The Federal Aviation Administration released the radio broadcast. What else is going on in the skies? Let's check in with Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. Peter, what do you have for us this week?
Well, all I can say, George, is anybody who hasn't run a UFO hotline anybody who believes there's not hell just hasn't run a UFO hotline. Well, good evening, and with the assistance of a trusty webmaster, earlier this evening I managed to update the UFO Center website, so all the cases I'm going to be talking about are now posted. And is often the case, George, I'd like to start with a sighting from a few years ago, in this instance from May of 1982. A gentleman writes that in the early part of that month, as a 10-year-old in Polsbo, Washington, located just on the west side of Puget Sound, he was walking to his middle school outdoor gym class when his attention was suddenly drawn to a very bright object that appeared to be hanging motionless in the western sky. He quickly had the presence of mind to call the object to the attention of his nearby classmate, and the two of them stood on the school track, marveling at just how bright and shiny it was and how perfectly disc-shaped it appeared to them to be. Moreover, the witness reports that the disc appeared to have a cupola or a bulge on top, just like a classic flying saucer might have. He estimates the object was visible for approximately 10 minutes or thereabouts. This first report first captured my attention principally because the witness estimates that the object was seen hovering directly above Bangor Submarine Base, which was at that time and still is one of the most sensitive and closely guarded U.S. military facilities on the West Coast, most of all because of its ICBM-armed submarines. The other reason it caught my attention, George, is because of its similarity to an event that occurred almost 20 years ago, specifically on April 22, 1998, which I reported on Coast as a guest with Art Bell, I believe just a day after it had occurred.
I remember that.
That second event, also above Bangor in April of 1998, was featured in the Peter Jennings special on UFOs that first aired in February of 2005. Although, regrettably, that two-hour program did not delve into just how dramatic an event it really was and how aggressively the U.S. Navy is thought to have responded to the presence of a UFO hovering above their base, and most of all, above the special weapons storage area of that base. Very, very dramatic case. In brief summary, a gentleman in San Jose, California, writes that on Monday of this week, March 26th, at approximately 1 minute past midnight, an object was witnessed and photographed by security cameras in the skies above San Jose. It suddenly blew up, and it rocked that city with a very loud concussion. Anybody in the San Jose area who is witness to that event, I would certainly be most grateful if they would report it using our online report form. And skipping to the final report, George, the final case is yet another description in which a witness reports that the bedroom that he or she was sleeping in was suddenly brightly illuminated, like it was daylight at high noon.
They're here.
In this instance, a student from the University of Montana at Bozeman, who elects to remain anonymous, unfortunately, even to the National UFO Reporting Center, was falling asleep at 1 a.m. this Tuesday, March 27th, when his room was filled with intensely bright light, and he thinks it led to 2 hours of missing time. That report and the others I've alluded to are posted to our website now for people's reading pleasure. And just in closing, George, I'd like to wish a happy Easter to all those Coast listeners who observe that celebration.
Thank you, Peter. That's Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. What's new with SETI, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence? Seth Shostak joins us next on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. Seth Shostak back with us, senior astronomer at SETI, search for extraterrestrial intelligence. No need to give him a full bio because you know, Seth, he's a regular contributor here on Coast to Coast. Mr. Shostak, good to have you back.
Well, it's good to be here, George.
What's going on with SETI these days? You've been having conferences, meetings. What's happening?
Yeah, well, of course, we are continuing to do a long-term project, which is to look at the dim bulb stars in the sky, 20,000 of them. They're called red dwarfs. Anybody who's taken Astronomy 101 will know about red dwarfs. Most stars are little guys. And there's good reason to look at them because they have a lot of planets that look like they might be habitable, so we think. But the other thing that's really been somewhat interesting in the past couple of weeks, roughly 2 weeks ago, we had a conference. People came from around the world, actually.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, there were about, well, yes, I hope they liked the food. There were roughly 40 of them, and they were presenting one talk after another about new thoughts when it comes to looking for ET. So that was most definitely very interesting.
Is the thought, Seth, that there are ETs out there? Do you think the majority believes that now?
Oh, yeah. No, I think that the majority of the public has certainly believed that for a very long time. I mean, you can look at, you know, polls taken, well, certainly back to the 1990s. I think it was much earlier than that, in fact. And typically 50 to 80% of the public says yes to the question, do you think there's intelligence out there or other life out there? Other life doesn't have to be intelligent. And so the percentages go up a little bit more. But, yeah, that's not so much the issue. Maybe you're asking, do scientists believe that? You know, I don't know of any polls that have, you know, asked scientists that, but if you just go down the street and grab the next 10 scientists you see, if it's somehow obvious by their hairdos or something that they're scientists, I think that 80% of them would say yes, too.
Seth, let me ask you this. I mean, the folks at SETI, yourself included, believe that there's extraterrestrial life out there, or you wouldn't be doing what you're doing. You wouldn't be listening for it. How come you don't believe that they possibly came here?
Well, it's not impossible for them to come here. I'll be the first to admit that. But the chances that they've come within, shall we say, historic times, just say the last 10 or 15,000 years, right? The Earth has been here for 4.5 billion years. There's been life on the Earth for probably 4 billion, certainly 3.5, right? So, you know, 10,000 years as a part of 4 billion years is a very, very tiny fraction of that time. So if they're just coming here, you know, on a random basis, the chances that you'll be visited while you're around to notice it are very, very small. Now, you know, maybe they did come, maybe they, you know, took a look at Rome and decided they didn't like the fish oil or whatever it was they were serving for dinner and left. That could be, but the Romans didn't write it down, and there's no evidence. When you go into Rome, you don't, you know, dig up some ruins, you don't find Klingon cell phones or anything like that. That would be pretty convincing, but short of that, it's pretty hard to tell. Maybe they visited the dinosaurs, but, you know, the dinosaurs didn't write it up.
Seth, every time a planet has been discovered by either the Kepler Space Telescope or some other means, do you folks at SETI kind of aim the array of telescopes, listening devices that way, just in case?
Well, we used to, George. You know, when Kepler first got underway a couple of years ago now, and, you know, started finding planets around other stars, of course, we swung our array of antennas in the direction of these star systems, hoping to pick up the signal. But eventually, it was like hearing the same jokes over and over again. You know, you got a little bit tedious because there were more and more planets. And at that point, we noticed something very interesting, or I should say the astronomical community noticed something interesting, and that was, well, most stars have planets. You know,
the actual
percentage might be 70%, 80%, 90%, but it's the majority. So, you know, you could just swing the antennas at any reasonable star and might as well pick nearby ones because signals would be stronger. And with a very high probability, it will have planets. So we stopped concentrating on the individuals, as it were, and went with a crowd.
15 years ago, you and I were talking on this program, and we talked about how the primordial soup in the universe is the same, that you're going to have the complexity of what you have on Earth, you're going to probably have it on other planetary systems. And then if they're, you know, in that Goldilocks zone with their star, you may have the right temperatures, you may have the right complexity of water, oxygen, and atmosphere. It's just a matter of time before we find more and more of those planets, isn't it?
Well, you know, again, on the basis of studies mostly by Kepler, as you've already mentioned, we now know that maybe 1 in 5 stars, 1 in 6, maybe it's 1 in 10, but, you know, hardly makes any difference. Let's say it's 1 in 6 stars has a planet that is in that Goldilocks zone, right?
That means there are a lot of planets.
Yeah, they're like a trillion in our galaxy.
Oh.
By the way, we can see 2 trillion other galaxies if our galaxy isn't up to your standards. So, yeah. There are a lot of them out there, and, you know, most of them are bad, but if I buy a trillion lottery tickets, I had the feeling that one of them will be a winner at least.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what's so exciting about that. And if life started, you know, aside from some of the incredible theories we've had on the show about life on this planet, but a 4.5 billion-year planet, when did life, intelligent life, in your opinion, really start?
Well, I tend to be sort of anthropocentric, being a Homo sapiens. I'm not sure about the sapiens part, actually. But being a Homo sapiens, you know, I tend to think that, well, intelligence, they're something like us. You know, people who study dolphins prefer dolphin intelligence, I think, in many cases. So, but if you just say, okay, they've got to be able to build a milling machine or invent a computer or, from the standpoint of SETI, build a radio transmitter or maybe a big laser so that they can signal us, then, you know, that species arose about 300,000 years ago, which again, you know, that's what, that's one millionth or something. No, it isn't quite that, but it's a very tiny fraction of the age of the Earth. In other words, the Klingons could have a SETI experiment that's been going for 4 billion years, and, you know, they wouldn't have picked up anything. They would have struck us.
Exactly, exactly. So we're 4.5 billion years old, 300,000 years ago, technically, intelligent life started popping up. So what about a civilization or a star system, a cluster, that is 9 billion years old? I mean, the universe is 14 billion years old. So those star clusters that started earlier than we did, they had a jump start of billions and billions of years. They've got to have had civilizations that cropped up and that they're way advanced if they're still alive.
Yeah, well, I think that that's a good argument, actually. What you're saying is that, you know, the majority of stars are older than the sun, and on average by many billions of years. I mean, these little runty red dwarfs that we're aiming our antennas at, the Allen Telescope Array, I mean, those guys, they don't die for 100 billion years. Well, the Big Bang was only 13 billion years ago, so, you know, those little guys aren't even in red dwarf high school yet, right? They're just getting underway. Every one of them that was born is still around. And if there's life that's, you know, popped up on a planet around one of those guys, you're right. It could be billions of years more advanced than we are. Now, that doesn't mean they're still around. I mean, species last for, you know, varying lengths of time. Typically on Earth, they live, you know, literally about 1 million years, and then something happens to them. But if they can figure out how to avoid their own extinction, yeah, there could be some pretty ancient, accomplished aliens out there.
Maybe they go to other star planets and start life. Who knows? We're going to take phone calls next with Shostak on Coast to Coast AM. Well, as we move into April on Sunday, on Easter Sunday, I'm looking at the calendar, and our Scottsdale event is only 3 weeks away, April 21st. Wow, it's coming up, and we're going to have a great time at the Virginia G. Piper Theater. Come on by. Tickets are selling like crazy right now. The event is going to be on Saturday. A number of guests, music, dancing, you know, you name it. We're going to have it, plus a meet and greet after the event. How do you get tickets? Go to coasttocoastam.com, click the events at the top of the homepage, and it opens up. It's also in the carousel reel that revolves. You'll be able to see that, too. Here's the phone number for those of you who do not have a computer for the box office there. Again, it's the Virginia Piper Theater, April 21st. You got to remember that date. The box office number is 480-499-8587, 480-499-8587. And for those of you in Las Vegas, well, you're not left out. At the Silverton Casino, June 9th, we're having our live stage show there, and that is going crazy. So take advantage of those tickets by going to events at coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast, Seth Shostak with us from SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. We'll get to your calls this half hour. Next hour, Linda Moulton Howe joins us with her incredible series of reports. Seth, what took us as a star system so long to form? The universe, 14 billion years old. We're 4.5 billion years old, about a 10 billion year lapse. Why did it take 10 billion years for us to pop up?
Well, that's the luck of the draw, George. You know, there's stars being formed now. If you look at the Andromeda, no, not the Andromeda, you look at the Orion Nebula, which you can see in the winters, you know, with your naked eye, actually, and a pair of binoculars, it's pretty darn impressive, actually. You know, there's stars being born in there as we speak. So stars are being born all the time because there's still the raw material to make stars in the universe, which is just gas, really gas and dust, okay? And there's still the fair amount of that left. About 10% of the, you know, the poundage of the Milky Way is still in gas and dust, not in stars, in gas and dust. So, you know, it'll continue to make stars. It's not making them nearly as quickly as it did in the beginning, but they're still being made. The bad news is actually not for us, because, you know, you could say, well, we're kind of late to the scene, but we're not all that late. In another roughly, I don't know, maybe another 100 billion years, you know, you won't be able to make new stars anymore because there won't be enough stuff to do that.
Well, Hawking believes, the late Stephen Hawking, that the universe will die.
Well, I tell you, this is what happens if you want to adjust your stock portfolio accordingly. As I say, in roughly, you know, 10 to 100 billion years, the last stars will die. There won't be new stars being made. They'll burn out. You know, some of them take longer to burn out than others. The sun's going to go in another 5 billion years, but we're talking a lot more than that. We're talking 100 billion years. The last stars die, and then what happens? Well, it gets dark at night, and, you know, maybe nothing very interesting is happening, but still there's a little bit of energy left in the universe, and stars will kind of have fender benders with one another, which will kick some of them out of the galaxy altogether. There probably isn't going to be anybody around to see this, but anyhow, and kick other stars into the center of our galaxy where a giant black hole will swallow them up. And if you wait long enough, and when I say long enough, I mean really long, then the galaxies just become giant black holes, and then, according to Stephen Hawking, the giant black holes slowly evaporate, and in a Google year, a Google years is a 1 followed by 100 zeros, the last big black hole will, you know, check out, and that's the last thing that will really happen in the universe.
In this universe. What about the multiverse?
Well, I don't know what's happening in other universes because they haven't sent me any email, but, you know.
They might.
But there could be other universes.
How far out can we say, assuming that, let's assume the Big Bang was some kind of bang of light that started it all. 14 billion years ago, how far out do we see light when it began? How far have we been able to go?
Well, probably the farthest thing we can see today, I mean, is the what's called the, you know, the 3-degree background. It's just a little bit of radio noise, actually, that was discovered in the mid-1960s by some well, some guys at the Bell Labs, actually, in New Jersey. And it's just sort of a cosmic static coming from everywhere. Now, actually where it's coming from is from 10,000 years after the Big Bang.
After.
Actually more like 30,000 years after the Big Bang, but it doesn't matter. It was almost right at the Big Bang. Not quite, but almost right at the
Which Big is Bang. Nothing in terms of space-time.
Yeah, 30,000 years, whatever
nothing.
It is. You know, it was very early. But in any case, that's when the universe got cool enough that you could have atoms and stuff like that. That's the farthest back we can see. So, if you will, that's like 14 billion light years away.
That is amazing. Will we ever see the Big Bang?
Well, that would be nifty indeed. I don't know how close you can get to seeing the Big Bang. But gravitational waves, which, as you know, were the big story in 2 years ago, and people got Nobel Prizes for finding gravitational waves with these instruments, LIGO in particular.
Even Einstein knew about it way before the instruments.
Well, he certainly predicted them, although there were a lot of people, and even Einstein himself, I've read somewhere that he wasn't entirely convinced that they exist, but they do. And in principle, maybe gravitational waves, the big, you know, the Big Bang may have produced lots of gravitational waves that we could see with instruments like this, although they'd have to be considerably more sensitive, I believe. But, you know, that's a possibility, and that would be interesting, but that's something we'll see in the future.
All right, let's go to the phones now. Steve is truck driving in Alabama, east of the Rockies. Hey, Stephen, go ahead.
How are y'all doing this evening, gentlemen?
Great, Steve. Thank you.
Seth, I've got a couple of quick questions for you. First of all, I know that we're constantly spewing out all kinds of signals out in outer space. That question would be, based on our current technology, how far would it be estimated that those signals would travel? Two, if a civilization was more advanced than us, could it be possible instead of using radio waves, they may be using more of a, say, quantum entanglement with quantum computers to communicate with each other?
Yeah, well, quantum computers are presumably in our future, maybe not too far off, at least if you believe everybody who's, you know, invested in that. But, you know, quantum communication, it's true that quantum entanglement, what you're talking about, is a kind of a spooky action at a distance. That's what Einstein called it, where you look at a particle here and its twin, which might be, you know, halfway to the Andromeda galaxy or even farther, instantly has its properties changed. Now, that sounds like you could send messages, but it turns out you can't send messages instantly. That violates Einstein. So they're probably not using quantum entanglement for sending messages. They may be using it to encrypt messages that are sent in, you know, email or whatever. We're going to be doing that fairly soon, I suppose. But sending messages faster than the speed of light? Al Einstein says he can't do it, and there's a very good chance that he was right.
Well, there sure was. And go ahead, Steve. What was that first question?
The first question was, based on our current technology, the signals that we are constantly sending out into the outer space, out into the system and all, how long would it be theoretical before those signals fade away before they're unrecognizable again?
Do they ever die off, Seth?
Well, no, they don't really die off. They get weaker. You know, just like you go outside with a flashlight and you aim it at the moon, you can do that. And, of course, you know, you get 1 mile above your backyard and, you know, that flashlight isn't going to look very bright. And you get 100 miles and it's going to, you know, look 10,000 times dimmer.
Yeah.
And you get to the moon, it's going to be very, very dim. But if you had a big enough telescope on the moon, you could see it. And the same is true with our transmissions into space, those TV signals or radar, that sort of stuff, FM radio. All that does go out into space, and it never goes away, really. It just gets weaker, so it takes a bigger and bigger antenna at the other end to pick it up. There is this, though, Steve, and that is, of course, we've only been sending those signals into space, and not deliberately, really, since the Second World War. So the farthest of them is, you know, like 70 light years out. That's not very far.
SETI is only listening. You're not sending, right?
We are not. We leave that to you, George.
Well, wait a minute. Stephen Hawking told me not to do it.
Did he tell you personally?
No, not personally, but he did say be very careful what you send out.
Yeah. Well, you're mostly on AM, so you don't have to worry too much about this because AM doesn't actually go into space too well. But
well, no, we bounce around the country and the world.
Well, that's where probably most of the listeners are. But it's the case that what he was referring to, of course, was the idea that if you make deliberate transmissions toward the sky, You don't know who might pick them up, and they might not be friendly, and they might just, you know, launch their interstellar battle wagons and come to Earth and incinerate the place and, you know, really ruin your whole day. I don't subscribe to that paranoia myself, George, because, as we just pointed out, I mean, we've been broadcasting since the Second World War, so any aliens that have the ability to harm us, if they could actually send some sort of weaponry in our direction from light years away, well, they probably have big antennas, and they might be picking up I Love Lucy. Who knows? And so, you know, our existence has already been betrayed. So, yeah, you can, if the world, you know, burns up tomorrow, maybe you can blame those early TV broadcasts.
We go to Cleveland now. First-time caller Neil's with us, Seth. Go ahead, Neil. Good to have you on the show.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Good. Thank you.
So I have a brief, ridiculous story, and it still boggles me. So I'm 35. I was 19. There was three of my buddies. We were in a park, in a car, waiting for a phone call from some girls to meet up with. And this still gives me, like, chills. Me and my buddies, we call it the blue light. I'm in the front seat. I have a friend in the passenger seat on the phone. I have a buddy in the back seat talking to me, telling me a story. I turned behind me, and behind me, I don't know where it stopped, but there was an indigo blue beam of light. I turned back up front, turned to my buddy that's telling me the story. It gets closer. I stopped listening to kind of what he's saying. My friend in the front seat still on his phone. Turned back up front. I turned behind me. It's closer again. Before I hit our car, I knew it was going to hit. And when I hit our car, it was this indigo blue light that I've never in my life experienced. And it just like lit up our car.
And, how long did it last?
It's kind of funny. The one question I have, you know, this lost time, you know, people like lose hours.
Yeah.
I felt that lost time because after it was gone and disappeared, all of us were staring at my clock on my car, like zombies. And then until somebody chuckled and were like, huh, what was that? My friend had dropped his phone when the blue light hit our car and just picked it up and was talking like normal. And, I'm assuming only minutes went by because he got back on the phone and conversation was normal. But, like,
we lost you there.
Oh, they came back.
You still there, Neil?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, there you go. We lost you for a second. Okay, let's get some quick take from you, Seth. There's no question something happened to these people. They're in their car, and they get illuminated by something. What do you think it was?
Well, you know... Without more than just the description there from Neil, I can't say. I mean, you know, some things occur to me, like, you know, maybe there was a motorcycle behind him with a really bright LED.
Or a helicopter above or something?
Yeah, it could be. I would point it out to Neil, something that he undoubtedly already knows, and that is this whole idea that the aliens will use big bright lights to come up behind you. I think that first appeared in Close Encounters of the Third Kind by Spielberg, because that's what happened.
He lit up Richard Dreyfuss's truck.
With Dickie Dreyfuss in his truck, exactly. And, you know, ever since then, people report bright lights coming up behind them when they're in their cars. So I don't know what that says, but it's something to keep in mind.
We have Sherry in Memphis, Tennessee now. Hi, Cher. Go ahead.
Hi. I love listening to your program. You have great guests.
Well, thank you, Sherry.
I wanted to ask, when you're out at night and you got the brightness of light, has anybody ever calculated, percentage-wise, how much of it comes from the moon and how much of it comes from the stars, which are so far away?
In terms of light?
Yes. How much of the light that brightens up the evening, is it mostly the moon or what percentage?
Well, if it's a full moon, you get a lot of light from the moon. But if it's like a crescent moon or something, you don't get a lot. But, Mr. Astronomer, we don't get much from the stars.
No, but, you know, but actually, Sherry, that's a good quiz question for an astronomy 101 course.
Or a game show.
Well, a game show, that means that they read the answer somewhere. But for an astronomy 101 class, they have to figure out the answer. And it wouldn't be hard to do it. I don't know that I can do it sitting here late at night, but my guess is that the moon is putting out a considerably larger, greater amount of light than all the stars put together. And, you know, could figure it out, but I don't know the answer off the top of my head, Sherry. It's a good one, a good question, and I would maybe I'll figure it out before next time.
We've got Walter in Pennsylvania now. Hello, Walt. Go ahead.
Hi, George. As usual, George, it's truly great to be on with you once again, and I'm truly gratified and honored to be on with Dr. D'Souza.
Shostak.
What's his name? Shostak?
Shostak. But we'll
my apologies.
D'Souza, though, is going to be my guest in Scottsdale. That's okay. That's good. You've got premonitions.
I thought Tom told me D'Souza. Well, my apologies then, too. I'll just say Seth, I think.
That's good enough.
That's
easy. Dr. Seth. Georgia, I've become, inadvertently, I've become part of a locally produced radio program. It's on Sunday mornings where, as you know, George, I'm an atheist agnostic, and on this show I come on and I debate the quote-unquote Bible thumpers.
All right.
And George, I'm amazed at how many people have not come to accept evolution as fact, because really evolution is probably the most proven tenet in all of science, George. The fossil evidence is simply overwhelming. You know, I have people call in and say, well, where's the missing link? Well, I say, you know, we have in Africa, we have these lungfish. When the ponds dry up, they get up out of the one pond and walk on their fins to another.
Well, I think what you can have, though, Walt, I believe that you can have creationism and Darwinism, evolution, at the same time. I think it mixed. Seth, you want to jump in on that?
Hey, I'm with Walter.
Uh-huh, two against one, huh?
Yeah. Well, listen, I think that the evidence...
We'll get Stanton Friedman back to debate you then.
he's retired right now.
No, he's still doing his thing.
Really? Oh, I thought I read that he had retired. Okay.
No, he'll never retire.
Well, okay. But in any case, no, Walter, I agree with you that the evidence for... evolution is incredibly strong. And by the way, in the context of aliens, you know, when people ask me, and they do occasionally ask me, they say, well, do you think that maybe Homo sapiens was planted here by some alien race? And, you know, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense, because if you go to the Natural History Museum, you look at our simian ancestors, and they look pretty much like us when you reduce them down to bones, and even if you don't. And then before them, you get another critter, and then another critter, and you go all the way back to the fish that we're descended from, and they look pretty much like us, too. They got a backbone. They got all this, you know, all the usual parts. So, you know, I think it's unequivocal that the biological evolution has occurred.
I love the interpretation of the late Zachariah Sitchin, who interpreted Sumerian tablets in cuneiforms to depict a alien race that came here and genetically altered whatever species would have been on the planet at the time, and here we are. That's an interesting theory, Seth.
Yeah, I'm interested to read his paper on it.
All right, my friend. Stay in touch with us, Seth. Always great talking to you.
Thanks very much, George.
Seth Shostak from SETI, his website linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Up next on Coast to Coast, Linda Moulton Howe with her series of special reports. Then in the last hour of the show, we call it Conversations with Linda. We'll take your calls.